Book 1, Chapter 10 of The Wealth of Nations is best known for its discussions of inequalities of wages and where those come from. This chapter is titled, Of Wages and Profit in the Different Employments of Labor and Stock. Smith notes that because of the force of competition, wages do indeed tend to equality, but there are some important exceptions, some reasons why equality may not hold, and this chapter is all about those exceptions. In modern terminology, we now call these compensating differentials, and that's a common topic in labor economics. The first major exception cited by Smith has to do with what he calls honor and disgrace. That is, some professions are esteemed more than others. Smith gives the example of a butcher who does a lot of hard, dirty work and maybe to some extent is looked down upon, and Smith argues that as a result, the butcher will be paid more than would otherwise be the case. Smith even cites a public executioner as a more extreme example of this phenomenon. On the other side of the ledger, Smith cites fishermen. Well, a lot of people, they go fishing for fun. So Smith argues that people who are fishermen for a profession, precisely because this is perceived as being somewhat enjoyable, well, they will earn wages which are lower than average. And again, this is enforced by a mechanism of supply and demand. If going fishing is fun, that will mean more people will tend to be fishermen. That increases the supply of fishermen, and in a long-run equilibrium, that will lower the wages of fishermen. Smith's analysis is quite correct here, but just to note a difference between Smith's time and ours, circa 2013, being a fisherman in the United States, it's actually one of the most dangerous occupations, and for that reason, people who work out on fishing boats, they actually earn pretty high wages. As another factor, Smith cites the difficulty of learning a business. Of course, the more difficult it is to learn a trade or avocation, the higher the wage in that occupation will be, the easier it is to learn, the more that will ease supply, and it will in turn lower wages for that occupation. The inconstancy of employment is yet another factor cited by Smith, and he talks about colliers, people who work in coal mines on a freelance basis. They only have work some of the time, and again, this discourages entry into that line of work, and all other things considered, it tends to make wages higher than they otherwise would be. In areas where extreme trust is required, such as overseeing work with gold or having people bring in their gold to a goldsmith, Smith argues that when trust is required, this limits supply, and again, in return, it will lead to higher wages in that occupation. Yet another feature cited by Smith is probability of success in pursuing a given line or trade. Smith cites the example of someone who sets out to learn how to work with shoes. He says success in this, being able to work with shoes, is nearly certain. That, of course, tends to attract a lot of people to working with shoes, and it makes wages correspondingly lower. For an offsetting example, Smith chooses that of opera singer. Smith argues that many people may set out trying to become a famous opera singer, but very few of them succeed. That will tend to raise wages for the opera singers who do become famous. Smith makes a second point about opera singers. In his day, being an opera singer was considered by many people as somewhat disreputable. That also will tend to raise the wages of opera singers. But of course, in today's world, 2013, if anything, we see the opposite. Being an opera singer arguably is higher status, and that tends to keep the wages of opera singers somewhat lower. Most of this chapter looks at differential payment for wages of labor, but Smith notes that many of these same arguments also apply to the profits of capital, and in that case, the two which matter the most are the general agreeableness of a given occupation and the risk of employing one's capital in that line of business. For instance, higher risk will mean higher returns. Again, it's the same basic line of reasoning rooted in supply and demand. This book is divided up into two quite separate parts, and in part two of the book, Smith really shifts gears. He's working in the same analytic framework, but here he is looking at the law, and he's going to consider apprenticeship and occupational licensing by government as factors which restrict the supply of labor and lead to a kind of combination or collusion and lead to higher prices and lower labor mobility and lower economic efficiency. But here, all the action is going to be on the side of the law. Smith in particular strongly objects to the legal requirement that a lot of trades require 7 years, that's right, 7 full years of training as an apprentice before you can become an actual producer or master. Smith argues this is an unjustified legal restriction, that basically the market should be allowed to decide how much training is needed, and Smith has a quite biting and detailed critique of how this simply leads to higher prices, lower levels of entry, creates a harder labor market, and in general it lowers standards of living. In the final part, Smith has a biting and detailed analysis of the poor laws and how they restrict the mobility of labor. As the poor laws were then written, in order to receive aid, you had to attach yourself to a particular locality for some spell of time, and if you tried to move to another locality, it would be much harder or maybe impossible to get aid. Smith argued this restricted the mobility of labor and in some ways increased the incidence of poverty. Overall, I view Book 1, Chapter 10 as one of the very best parts of The Wealth of Nations. The analytic sections hold up very well, they're extremely impressive, and they're also beautifully written with excellent examples. The policy work shows just what an excellent command of detail Smith had and how much importance he attached to laws, institutions, and incentives when it came to economic policy.